If you ever watch over-the-air television or surf to any number of websites, the campaign ads are coming at you from the left and the right and sometimes the center.
We have the desert in our blood. Arizonans are strong and independent.
Arizona born. Kyrsten Sinema.
We love our country. We're skeptical of our government.
Securing our border isn't just about illegal immigration. It's about stopping dangerous drugs, illegal weapons, and human trafficking. It's about protecting our communities. President Trump is committed to building the wall, but many in Congress don't share this commitment, including my opponents.
They illegally cross our border. Criminals, violent gang members, and drugs, putting us all at risk. Representatives Martha McSally and David.
But the ads we've gotten so used to invading our space wouldn't have been possible without this groundbreaker from President Lyndon Johnson's 1964 campaign against Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater.
The stakes to make a world in which all of God's children can live are to go into the dark. We must either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
Robert Mann is a professor of communications at LSU and wrote a book about that LBJ ad called Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds. And he's with me to talk about the ad and the dramatic changes we've seen since then in the business of convincing us which way to vote. Bob, why was that LBJ ad from 1964 so significant, even though it only ran one time?
Well, that ad was transformational, and it wasn't so much that it had a huge impact on the presidential race of 1964, because Lyndon Johnson was going to win no matter what he did on television in the way of advertising. But the ad transformed the ad and the other ads that Doyle Dane Burnback prepared for Johnson in 1964 transformed the way that politicians thought about political advertising. It turned it from a very rational, fact-based presentation of the candidates' positions or policies, many times 30-minute long speeches, in fact, into a very short appeal to the emotions. And it really showed politicians that they'd been doing it wrong, and that they had not really understood the television medium.
People often bring up Citizens United, but we've seen the real expansion of those IEGs, those independent expenditure groups. How much has that changed what you're seeing in terms of ads, in terms of the fact there may not necessarily be advocating for a candidate, but there's a point of view that's very clear there?
I mean, it's the Wild West now. I mean, it's just a completely different environment than we saw until very recently. Just about anybody can get into the business legally. But I think maybe more important is just the barriers to producing these TV spots and disseminating them they've just collapsed. I mean, a good example is Beto O'Rourke, who has a very good media consultant producing his ads, has a spot up right now that was produced entirely on using iPhone video. The cost of getting into the business of producing ads is now the cost of getting a cheap video camera that in many cases are almost broadcast quality, and you're in the business. You can do a lot of harm or you can do a lot of good.
We still see TV ads, even though this is a non-presidential election year. We have a major U.S. Senate race here in Arizona. We're seeing ads every night from both the Republican candidates and then the Democratic perceived frontrunner. But I know there's been a lot more going on in terms of YouTube, in terms of social media. How do you think that has impacted either the message or the way people get the message?
Well, the difference there is that, you know, what you're seeing on television, broadcasting, even cable, really is broadcast. It's to a broader audience. It is targeted in a sense, because the people, the candidates and their media buyers know generally the profile of the people who are watching these particular shows, but it's still a broadcasting of that message. What we're seeing now on social media, on the internet, is the narrow casting of these messages. And we all know, we're all well aware of how much of our data is out there, and how Facebook and other marketers have that information, and they use that information to send messages to me that someone sitting in the cubicle next to me, maybe on the same website, would not see. because that person is not a target of that message. And so the ability of these advertisers to narrow cast is so much more sophisticated, and it's only getting more and more sophisticated. And the nefarious part of it is, the one thing about broadcasting a message is that since everybody sees it, including the press, you got to be a little more careful about what you say. You can't be, you know, you got to hew to the facts. You can't be racist or too racist. There are some norms that you have to observe. In the narrow casting world, you can get away with a lot more because, you know, only the people who want to see it are actually seeing it, and it may be that stuff never really gets out into the broader world.
I was thinking about high-efficacy voters, and I think naturally maybe the assumption is that high-efficacy voters are people who are more informed, but maybe they're just more passionate about their candidate or their particular party, and they sort of vote the same way. When it comes to actually being an informed voter, coming back to talking about campaign ads, how much of an influence do campaign ads have today? If we get away from some of the narrow casting we talked about, if the traditional TV ad, do you think it's more of a reinforcement of what someone already believes, or can they be influential and persuasive, whether for good or bad?
Well, I think that is, you have hit upon, I think, what is the essential question about political advertising, and that is it effective? And if it is effective, who is it effective with? And that's one of the things that I always talk about with my students when I'm teaching about campaigns. And a couple of years ago during the presidential election, but we took the 11 battleground states that the candidates were fighting over, and we estimated that there were 4 to 5%, an average of 4 to 5% undecided voters in those 11 states. And then we took all the money that the candidates were spending on political advertising in those 11 states, which was, you know, hundreds, perhaps $1 billion over the life of the campaign. When you look at the obscene amount of money that the candidates are using to influence a very small percentage of the electorate, it makes you wonder if that's not the, if that really is the best way to reach the voters. I mean, you could afford to send a campaign worker to every one of their homes and take them out for coffee for the price that they're using for these ads. I think the premise of your question is that, you know, the 95% of the voters go to, you know, enter the election season already knowing who they're going to vote for, because they're either solidly in the Democratic fold or solidly in the Republican fold. And we're spending billions and billions of dollars trying to influence, you know, 5 to 10% of the electorate. And it just seems like a really inefficient way to do it when these candidates are broadcasting, not narrowcasting, but broadcasting these spots, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to do it.
Robert Mann is a professor at Louisiana State University. He's also the author of the book Daisy Petals and Mushroom Clouds, LBJ, Barry Goldwater, and the Ad That Changed American Politics. Bob, thanks for the time this morning.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Steve.